begin with the invocation.
Toward the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls, who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. Greetings and welcome to all who are gathered here today. And greetings also to those who are listening in from afar. I'd like to express my apologies for the inconvenience in the postponement of this class and say that with your good thoughts and prayers, I'm feeling much better now, with the exception of the occasional sniffle or sneeze, which you might hear today. The subject, as has been announced, is planetary prophetology, continuation of a theme that has been already explored in the two prior classes. But in conceiving of the vision of a planetary prophetology, a concern very quickly arises. And that concern is a very legitimate concern. And that concern is this: that we can observe that the subordination of women, misogyny, the dominance of patriarchy, is a global phenomenon and is present within every major world religion today. And so, if our project is to conceive of a planetary prophetology, a prophetological vision that acknowledges the validity of all of the world's faiths, and attempts to articulate a single global flow of wisdom that includes them all, is there not a danger that this planetary vision will become an aggregate of patriarchies, a super patriarchy, so to speak, concatenation of the patriarchal tendencies inherent in all religions, conceived on a global scale? It is a very off-putting idea. So we need to explore further the nature of the misogynistic bias inherent in the world faiths, and whether it is essential or accidental. If it is essential, then it derives directly from the mystic inspiration of the prophets. And if it is accidental, it is an overlay, so to speak, an overlay that buries under its weight the pure egalitarian message that is the ultimate truth of revelation. And if so, we must strip away the veils of accretions, cultural accretions, to reveal that egalitarian essence and seek out the exegeses, the mystical techniques of interpretation that reveal the occluded feminine dimension of revelation. So that is an enormous undertaking, but also an extremely urgent one, living in an era in which we are witness to the atrocities of war, gargantuan pollution, ferocious fundamentalism, all symptoms of an inherent imbalance. And the reaffirmation of the feminine is essential to redressing that imbalance. Now, having introduced this subject, I must begin with an admission, which is that I do not feel well placed at all to speak on this subject. On the contrary, it is presumptuous for a man such as myself to speak for and about women's experience of the sacred. And ultimately, what is most necessary is to bring forth women's own voices to define their own visions of the sacred. But having said that, I must also acknowledge that as a public figure representing a spiritual tradition, I would be remiss to ignore or sideline this important issue. And so I do venture forth into this conversation, but in a spirit of humility and respect, and recognizing that if I have some measure of authority to speak, it is by virtue of my own living relationships with women who have been an inspiration to me in my life, and also the recognition that every human being contains within both the masculine and feminine dimensions. Now, the vision of planetary prophetology that has been explored in these classes is inspired by the vision of Hazrat Pir Murshid Inayat Khan, my grandfather. And I want to begin by quoting his words from an autobiographical essay that he wrote titled East and West. He wrote this in the 1920s. There is no line of work or study which woman in the West does not undertake and does not accomplish as well as man. Even in social and political activities, in religion, in spiritual ideas, she excels man. I can see as clearly as daylight that the hour is coming when woman will lead humanity to a higher evolution. These are words that have oracular power. And Murshid was speaking in a time when in the country in which he lived, France, women had yet to obtain the right to vote or stand for office, which came only in 1944. And yet in his own organization, Murshid delegated the highest authority to women, and the senior-most leaders within the Sufi movement were four women: Rabia Martin, Sharifa Goodenough, Sophia Green, and Fazlmay Eglin. Later, at the end of his life, Murshid returned to India and explained his thinking on this subject to Khwaja Hassan Nizami, who oversaw the dargah of Hazrat Nizamuddin Aulia in Delhi, and who was among the very foremost Sufi authorities in that time. And later, Murshida Rabia Martin visited Khwaja Hassan Nizami. And having met Hazrat Pir Murshid Inayat Khan and Murshida Rabia Martin, Khwaja Hassan Nizami's thoughts on the subject of women's roles in Sufism were affected. And he explains this in his Roznamcha. He says, although we don't find reports in the biographies of the great ones of the past of them granting khilafat or succession to women, still, on investigating the principles and rules of Sufism, there does not appear to be any harm in granting females khilafat. Therefore, I gave permission to teach my silsila to the daughter of Hakim Altaf Hussein, Rashida Nisa Begum, and bestowed on her the name Malakut Begum. Especially in Europe and America, it is the women who can contribute to laying the groundwork and bringing to conclusion the work of spreading the message. Today, it is due to the efforts of these very women that Sufi Inayat Khan's thousands of disciples are increasing in Europe and America, in whom feelings of spiritual purity, moral goodness, worship of God, love, and empathy are to be found to a much greater extent than in others. So in this paragraph, we have a glimpse into the process whereby a tradition updates itself, updates its practices and protocols based on the clear evidence of the rightness of a new practice, in this case, the rightness of the inclusion of women. Which isn't to say that there haven't historically been exceptions and precedents in Sufi history. Of course, the very greatest Sufi of the earliest phase was Hazrat Rabia al-Adawiya of Basra, who lived in the 8th century. She was an ecstatic antinomian mystic. She is said to have gone about in less than modest dress and seemed to care little at all what people thought of her apparent immodesty. Until once she was seen to suddenly, after walking brazenly through the marketplace, retreat and hide. And she was asked, what is the reason for this change in behavior? And she answered, women must by law cover themselves in the presence of a man. And just now, on the street, I saw the saint Hassan al-Basri. And until this moment, I had never seen a man. Another great woman figure in the history of Sufism is the daughter of Khwaja Garib Nawaz, of Khwaja Moinuddin Chishti, his daughter Bibi Hafiza Jamal. And it is said that she was granted full authority for the passing of the transmission. She was made a Khalifa. Another great woman saint of India was Bibi Fatima Sam, who was the sole sister of Hazrat Nizamuddin Awliya. And people used to inquire whether it was really possible that she could be a saint if she was a woman. And Hazrat Nizamuddin answered that if a tiger jumps out from bushes, do you ask if it's a male tiger or a female tiger? And then there was a great saintly lady who played a very important role in the life of Hazrat Nayat Khan. When he went to Hyderabad, he had a certain objective, a desire at that time, and that desire was as yet unfulfilled. And his friend brought him to the presence of an old lady who sat under a tree. She was a Qalandar, a wandering dervish. And they approached her respectfully. And she took some food that she had been chewing in her mouth and took it out into her hand and offered it to Hazrat Inayat Khan. And he was a very prim and proper young man, and at first was very startled by this dilemma. He was being asked to take into himself this chewed food. And yet, in a spirit of trust, he did so. And he says that the very next day, that desire that he had long nurtured, it was fulfilled. Also, the mother of Hazrat Pir Murshid, Khadija Bi, played a very important role in his life. And we know that while she was pregnant with Murshid, she had visions of the prophets. The prophets came to her in her dreams with messages. Now, the reason that Murshid's oracular utterance that women shall lead humanity to a higher evolution is so striking is that it stands in sharp contrast against the long history of subordination, misogyny, repression that is all too familiar. We are all familiar, I think, with this heritage. And too much need not be said to prove its reality. The evidence is everywhere apparent throughout history. A striking example is the word hysteria, which describes a state of dementia, of emotional overexcitement. And that word is taken from the word hystera, the Greek word for the womb. So the condition of the woman, the possessor of a womb, is assumed to be incomparably inferior at the level of mind. And the consequence of this conception, of course, has had very real ramifications in women's life throughout history. However, it seems that it was not always so. Archaeological evidence reveals feminine figures, ceramic figures, that are the primary artifacts of the Paleolithic and Neolithic eras. So whatever evidence we do have about religion in prehistoric periods, it points to a religiosity that revolved around a deep acknowledgement of women's fertility and power. The matron figure was the primary symbol. This is evidenced in artifacts that can be traced far back into the, as far as the Paleolithic period, but which are abundantly to be found in the Neolithic period at sites such as Çatalhöyük in Turkey. And these relics, these artifacts, suggest a very different culture, a culture in which women's place was primary, in which fertility was celebrated. The settlements reveal minimal or no fortifications, and there is no evidence of organized warfare in these periods, as well as no evidence of centralized structures of authority. So all of the evidence suggests a time of peace, social equilibrium, and the predominance of the sacredness of the feminine. But somehow, somewhere, these patterns, these life rhythms were altered. And there are various theories about how and why that happened. According to Maria Imbutas, it was an invasion of nomadic pastoralists from Russia that swept down over Central and Southern Europe and dominated those matriarchal societies and repressed their religion and introduced instead the veneration of the sky god and martial tendencies. And this may historically correspond to a real situation. However, that explanation, of course, is Eurocentric. It does not explain the prevalence of patriarchy in other regions of the world, nor does it really explain the cultural progression that led to the domination of the male principle. Because after all, how did those Kurgans, the Kurgan nomads, how did they become patriarchal in the first place? We need to seek a fuller answer. The theory of the invasion might be part of the puzzle. And when we look to fuller analyses, of course, there are multiple theories. There is the theory that as agriculture developed, agriculture beginning with horticulture being naturally a feminine undertaking, the men serving primarily as hunters. But as agriculture developed technologically, it became big business, so to speak, and issues of a surplus arose, and surplus was equated with power. Questions of possession and property arose, and competition for property and possession. And within this women increasingly fell under the category of possessions. Another theory holds that the rise of patriarchy can be linked with the alphabet, with writing. This is an extremely interesting theory advocated by a neurosurgeon, Leonard Schlein, who reminds us that the brain is bicameral. The brain's functioning operates through two distinct but interrelated hemispheres, the right and the left. The right hemisphere associated with the functioning of the left side of the body, and the left hemisphere with the right side of the body. And there is, in the case of the human species, as opposed to every other species, there is extreme differentiation in the functioning of these two hemispheres of the brain. And the left hemisphere, which controls the right hand, is associated with, in language, grammar. And the right hemisphere is associated with cadence. So the left hemisphere is concerned with logical sequences, rational arguments, and the right hemisphere is associated with holistic judgments, intuitions, perceptions of musicality. These are two different modes of cognition. And of course, both men and women utilize both hemispheres of the brain. But historically, men have been socially conditioned to specialize in the activities associated with the left brain, and women more with right brain related activities. And it's also true that women have a greater number of connecting neurons in the corpus callosum, which determines the interplay between the two hemispheres. So women are biologically wired, so to speak, for greater integration. Now, verbal language includes visual signs, it includes the musicality, the cadence of the voice, whereas written language is reduced to terms that become increasingly abstracted from an embodied experience. And so the invention of the alphabet, first in cuneiform, in Sumer, and subsequently the development of alphabets leading to Phoenician, which is then the root of Hebrew, as well as Greek, as well as the Brahmi script used in India, represents an enormous innovation that had deep implications for global civilization. And one can see that this development coincides with the diminution of the importance of the goddess figure and the rise in the pantheons of those cultures, in the Babylonian pantheon and later in the Greek and Roman pantheons, the rise of the male figures and culminating in the hegemony of a figure in the Greek pantheon, the figure of Zeus, and in the Roman, of Jupiter. The formulation of the laws of Hammurabi coincide historically with the advent of the myth of the overthrow of the feminine Tiamat by the male divinity Marduk, who literally slays Tiamat and from her body creates the world. That myth of the slaying of the feminine divinity, who is now portrayed as the principle of chaos, as opposed to the order represented by the god Marduk. The advent of this myth corresponds to the enactment of the laws of Hammurabi, which is, of course, the further continuation of the logic of a civilization more and more determined by literary culture and its consequences. Now, it's also interesting to note the distinction between Hebrew and Arabic on the one hand, and Greek on the other hand. Hebrew and Arabic are on the Abjad system, which means that the alphabets are exclusively composed of consonants, whereas the Greek alphabet contains the introduction of vowels. That is an innovation. The innovation of the vowels into the alphabet in Greek represents, we might say, a continuation of this linear development of abstraction. Now, if in the Abjad system, where the vowel is not present, to read a text means to breathe the vowelization into the words. The words are not self-sufficient on the page or on the tablet. The words have to be animated by the breath of the body in the act of reading. Whereas in the Greek alphabet, the alphabet becomes more self-sufficient, closed, distinct from human biological processes. Now, a further development along these same lines is, much later, the introduction of movable type, the Gutenberg press, which standardizes texts, enabling absolute precision in the transmission of texts, which is the precondition for the flourishing of the exact sciences, as occurred subsequently in the Enlightenment and in the period of the Industrial Revolution. A certain civilizational trajectory was enabled by the furtherance of a literary culture that has become extremely technologically refined. Now, it's interesting that as soon as the vowels were introduced in the Greek alphabet, already Plato could begin to speak about what are called Platonic ideas, abstract ideas that exist in a void, so to speak, disembodied. That is, we might say, a natural consequence of the implications of this, the closed system of the Greek alphabet. A further implication is the textual transmission of printed texts that create the proper environment for the full elaboration of the modern rationalist, materialist, scientific worldview and its great advances in technology. But what is progressively lost in this arc is the living, breathing, organic relationship with meaning. Meaning becomes reduced to pure information, abstracted, existing in a plane of its own, beyond the earth. And you might say that the internet, in some way, is the apotheosis of this very progression. Interestingly, Philo, the Hellenistic Jewish philosopher, identifies Sophia, the feminine wisdom, with the vowels. He says that the Sophia principle is in the vowels. So we can see that the relationship between masculine and feminine is not unrelated to this question of development of autonomous texts, disembodied. Now, while the post-Neolithic period, the period of early recorded history, the historical period, what is sometimes called the Axial Age, is certainly a period in which the divine feminine experienced a demotion and the masculine principle was elevated. At the same time, we can look and find examples of the abiding relevance of the feminine in the theologies of this period, particularly in the experience of the mystics, who were never content to allow the feminine dimension of the sacred to be forgotten. So, for example, in the book of Proverbs, we find the voice of wisdom, Chokmah. Chokmah speaks as a celestial person. In Proverbs 8:22, she speaks and says, "The Lord created me, the beginning of his works, before all else that he made long ago." So there is in the Bible this very clear indication of the precedence of the sacred in the order of the sacred feminine in the order of creation. Now, in the monotheistic revelations, the revelations of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the feminine element of the divine continues to find a place, albeit sometimes within the subtext, one has to look deeply, but it is there. And the feminine is frequently associated with the principle of creativity, the act of creation. And God is the creator, and so God must evince this feminine dimension. And women, embodied women, are the symbol of this. So Hazrat Maulana Rumi writes in his Masnaviya Ma'navi, "Paratoi hakast an ma'shuq nist, khaliqast an guya makhluq nist." She is no mere object of affection. She is a ray of the truth. She is a creator, you might say. She is not created. Rumi is speaking here of women. She's not merely the object of your desire. She's a ray of God. She's not merely a created creature. She is creative. She is the living symbol of the divine creativity, the purest evidence of that creativity. And Ibn al-Arabi writes of the Nafas ar-Rahman, which is the breath of the all-compassionate. He understands creativity as a vast cosmic breath that releases the divine qualities from the confinement of the condition of God as a hidden treasure. This great breath carries the attributes into being, into life, into experience. A great sigh of creative compassion. And the name that he gives to this sigh, the Nafas ar-Rahman. And the word Rahman refers to the two foremost attributes of God repeatedly invoked in the Quran. Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, the merciful and the compassionate. And these two words both come from the root rahama. And that root describes the womb. The word for the womb is from the same root. So the most essential qualities of the divine creativity and love come from an affirmation of the womb. So that word, the breath of the all-compassionate, contains two words, Rahman, evoking the womb, and the other is nafas, which means a breath. But that word is also related to the word nafs, which means soul or self. And that word is grammatically in Arabic feminine. So sometimes that has been used against women. The argument has been made, women are of the nature of nafs, interpreting nafs as the lower self, the ego. However, nafs can also be nafs al-mutmaina, the tranquil, illuminated, the awake self. And the association with of the feminine with the nafs or the self indicates a recognition that women have a special experience of personhood, of what it means to care for children, to care for the world, to experience and affirm the embodied state, not merely to seek consolation in abstraction and transcendence, but the true affirmation of embodied, ensouled life on earth. That is indicated by the word nafs, and that is the correlate to nafas. Now we can also look at the name Allah, because as perhaps I've mentioned in a previous class, according to Sheikh Najmuddin Kubra, the word Allah is derived from the definite article Al, which is doubled. The L is doubled, becoming intensified thereby. So the definite article means the, and if it is intensified, it means the very, the one and only. So we have accounted for the A-L-L, and what remains? Ha. Ha. So for Najmuddin Kubra, God's name, Allah, means the ha, the breath. But what else is ha? Ha is the sound of the breath. It also is the feminine pronoun. That is how you make a feminine noun, by the addition to the noun of the suffix ha. So ha is the feminine pronoun, the feminine name. So it's right there implicit in the divine name Allah. And it is elaborated in the full form of the feminine pronoun hiya, hiya, which is the counterpart of huwa. And Gisu Daraz, a great Chishti saint, wrote in his Wujud al-Ashiqeen, the ocean absorbs all impurities. It has no bottom depth and no shore, so that one can say of it only, Hiya, Hiya, she is she. And if anyone demands, how dare I use a feminine pronoun for God? I'll answer that in the night ascension, the divine epiphanies of glory, the divine epiphanies of the glorious and high that appeared to our prince, peace and blessings, were also of feminine form. And speaking too of this feminine pronoun, the letter ha, Ibn Arabi says is in his commentary on the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq, his inspired poems. He says, my intention with this poem is to portray only her, that is the letter Ha, the feminine pronoun. I have no other attachments beside the one to her. For my attachment to the world of phenomena exists entirely for her sake, because she reveals herself in it.